fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today, we recap the issues raised at a conference this week in Wausau on one of the most controversial medical and philosophical issues facing the world today, the ethics of embryonic stem cell research. The day-long conference took place Tuesday at the Westwood Center and UW-Marathon County and was co-sponsored by Aspirus Wausau Hospital and the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Today we will hear the voices of the speakers at that event, some who see the promise of a new technology that could bring hope to those who suffer from heretofore incurable medical conditions, and others who have ethical questions related to the destruction of these embryos, each only 4 days old and only the size of the head of a pin, but they would say human nonetheless and worthy of protection. Our guests today are Mark Brown, Chair of the Philosophy Department at UW-Marathon County, and Frank Lozinski, Chair of the Bioethics Committee of Aspirus Wausau Hospital. As always, we want to hear from you. If you have an opinion on embryonic stem cell research, should we be doing it? Is the promise too great for us not to do it, especially given the fact that UW-Madison is a leader in the field, making Wisconsin a leader in the field? Give us a call at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Mark Brown, Frank Lozinski, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Mark, you really took the lead in organizing this seminar. What were you trying to accomplish?
I was trying to bring to the people of central Wisconsin some of the advantages of being in a state which has a world-class research institution, one which is at the center of biotechnology, University of Wisconsin-Madison. We had three leading figures from UW-Madison come up and speak about the science and ethics and political implications of stem cell research. And to be sure that we had a full spectrum of opinion, we brought in speakers from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and Franciscan University of Steubenville in Ohio.
And, of course, Patrick Lee from Franciscan University. That's a Catholic institution, and he had the pro-life point of view on stem cell research. So you had all of the ethical sides of this question covered. You also really focused on the medical technology during the afternoon session at the Westwood Center. Tell us about that.
We focused principally upon prospective treatments for Parkinson's disease and for diabetes. It is widely thought that those are two conditions which are likely to be among the first for human trials of stem cell-related therapies. It happens two of the leading researchers in that field were able to give us an up-to-date overview of the prospects for various ways to prevent the progression of those conditions.
And the other speakers during both the afternoon and the evening session, the others who were addressing some of the political and philosophical issues, we had, Cynthia Cohen.
Cynthia Cohen is one of the founders of the field of bioethics and the author of the most recent survey of the field of stem cell research, Renewing the Stuff of Life. So we had in her somebody with wide and deep expertise in the ethical problems that come up in this field.
And also
Alto
Charo, okay. She's a professor of law and bioethics at the UW-Madison School of Medicine.
That's right. And she is a national spokesperson on this issue in bioethics and in a whole range of them. She served on President Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Board, the National Academies of the Sciences, embryonic stem cell research protocols, and many others, which formulated policy at a national and international level.
And we will be hearing from all of these speakers during the hour that lies ahead. Frank Lozinski, tell us about the committee that you're on, the Bioethics Committee of Aspirus Wausau Hospital. It makes sense that a hospital would have a bioethics committee, but nonetheless, I'm sure it would surprise somebody to hear that Aspirus has one. What is the committee? What are you trying to accomplish on a day-to-day basis?
I think you'll find that most hospitals in the United States are organized with bioethics committees. And what they do as a membership of the committee that's made up of community members, physicians, social workers, chaplains, et cetera, community representatives from nursing homes and assisted living, what we do is address issues that are faced by specific patients, such as the possibility of removing someone from life support and the difficult decision in that, and supporting the physician, family, and or patient in their decisions that they follow.
And what prompted you to get involved with this particular seminar?
Well, actually, I say I'm along for the ride with Professor Mark Brown from UW-Marathon County, because he basically organized the whole conference. He is, and we have the opportunity for him to be a committee member on our bioethics committee. He's been here in the area since 1986, teaching philosophy, and also his interest in bioethics was a good segue to our committee and having his expertise. So we're honored and privileged to have him sit on our committee.
Is Aspirus involved in any way with stem cell research, whether it's embryonic or not embryonic?
No, we don't have the facilities for that.
Frank Lozinski, he's on the Aspirus Hospital Bioethics Committee. Mark Brown, professor of philosophy at UW-Marathon County and the Wisconsin colleges. And that's our subject today. We're going to delve into some of these arguments in just a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to delve into, our phones are open to you at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
For more information on regional programming for North Central Wisconsin here at Wisconsin Public Radio, or to have your community event listed with us, check out our local website at wpr.org/WLBL.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit a WPR sponsor, please let them know that you appreciate their support of the station. Thanks very much.
Let's go right to the phones. We have Ned in Wausau. Ned, you're on Route 51. Hello, Ned.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I thought it was an excellent conference on Tuesday. I went to the afternoon and evening sessions. And I think WIPS is to be congratulated for doing such a good job at bringing in nationally known speakers. These were not just your ordinary people. These were just experts in their field, and I was very pleased with the quality of the speakers that were brought in. I'd also like to talk about the afternoon session a little bit.
Yep.
The science that was presented was done very appropriately. Clive Svensson first, because he did a little more of an introductory talk and got people on board very well, and that was followed by John Oderico, and his was a more in-depth presentation. I had a number of people afterwards say they had a little trouble following part of his talk, but they were still able to get some value out of it. The first one was on neurogenitive degenerative disorders, and so I thought that was quite interesting, such as Parkinson's disease. And I really enjoyed seeing the possibilities of making significant progress on a disease like that. And then on John Oderico, he was talking more in terms of things like diabetes and pancreatic disorders, pancreatic diseases. That was also very interesting. I think that even as a biology professor, I find that talk was a pretty pretty advanced for a lot of my students in particular.
Ned, you're a biology professor where, here at UW-Marathon County?
Right, uh-huh. And I found that I found John's talk still very informative, and even if you couldn't follow every single detail of the expression of genes and so on that were brought up in his presentation, there was still value in his presentation for everybody that was there.
What did you as a biology professor learn at the event? You imagine lay people coming in and walking away with their heads full of new ideas and new possibilities. As somebody who works in the field, did you learn anything?
Well, yes. One thing that was presented, I think it was maybe in the evening by some of the scientists or maybe some of the ethicists, they were presenting the idea that some blastomeres, these are cells within an embryo, could be separated and could be brought back together again into a single embryo so that it could be possibly developing into more than one embryo, or it might come back as a clump of cells once again and become a single embryo. And I had not heard that before. That was new to me. And a second speaker was saying that even at the, I believe it was at the two-cell stage of embryonic development, one of the the people on ethics was saying that even at that early stage that there was some determination of the blastomeres, even at the two-cell stage. I'd never heard that
before. And why is that significant, Ned?
Well, because, that's very important in terms of what is the potentiality of that particular blastomere or cell. What is its capability or potential in terms of developing into all these different types of organs and tissues in the body? Is
how
it pluripotent, or is it just does it just have some capability?
The expression pluripotent means the ability of a cell to turn into any other cell of the body except for the placenta and the other extra embryonic components. So if a cell is pluripotent, it can't become a baby. If a cell is totipotent, then it can turn into every cell in the body and turn into a placenta, which will nurture that embryo and fetus throughout its development. And the question that Ned is raising is whether or not very early on, in the first couple of days, the cells which make up the embryo are capable themselves of turning into a baby down the line. And the answer to that seems to be yes. In fact, twins are, by and large, the result of just such a separation of the cells in the very early embryo, that is, identical twins.
Well, Ned, if this blastocyst, if this primitive embryo, if it has the potential of turning into a human being, how do you feel about the ethical implications of destroying it?
Well, I look at embryos and fetus as potential for life, and one of the things brought up in the evening session was very interesting by an MD in the audience, and that is she presented that her understanding was that 75% of all the pregnancies do not actually go to term and are not living babies as they are born. And so to me, both the first 2 months, which we normally call embryos, and from month 2 to 9, which we usually call a fetus, are potential for life. That's how I see them. And I know that's not a universal opinion, but that's my opinion. And since so many of them, since anywhere from 50 to 75%, depending on whose studies you're referring to, are going to not make it to term.
In other words, they're never implanted in the uterus in the first place. And
Might have been, or they might not have been, but they're at various stages where they might not make it to term and they might have a miscarriage, for example. There's so many of those that it's hard for me to state from my point of view that those embryos that are left over from fertility clinics and the embryos that are miscarriages and so on are all actual persons, because if they are, we need to give death certificates to all of them. Well, you know, we didn't ever, in most cases, give them a formal name and all these little technicalities. Not that they're any big deal, but the thing is, the point is where life begins.
You're saying if they're full human beings, we ought to be having funerals for all the ones that didn't make it?
Well, I mean, you could take it to the extreme and say maybe we should have, and I know this was just a joke during the day that came up, maybe we should give the IRS tax deduction to every single one of those potential you know, fetuses or embryos. And of course that was laughed at, and that was not really very a serious comment, and it was my own, so that was fine. But I'm just taking it to the extreme to show, you know, we don't really give all the full rights of being a human being and a citizen in our society to every single potential life that never takes a breath of air.
Ned, I want to thank you for the phone call, and I want to encourage all of you who are listening to call as well, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Do you agree with Ned, who just called up and who sees the young embryo, the 2 to 4 day old embryo, as being just a potential for human life, or do you think it's something more than that and needs to be protected? 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Frank Lozinski, are these some of the ethical questions that bioethics people have to deal with on a regular basis?
I think what you look at, if you look at the basic premises of bioethics, the four principles of bioethics have to deal with, one, autonomy, which is giving people their self-determination to choose what direction they would want to go. Beneficence, making sure that all the technology and the science is there to benefit people. Non-maleficence, that any of the technology or science would do no harm. And lastly, being justice, that it would be available to anybody in society, not just those that can afford it, but those that may not be able to afford it. And I guess we would look at that as being as fair as possible through those four basic principles, no matter what somebody chooses.
Those four principles conflict with each other sometimes, don't they?
Correct.
Potentially,
yep.
The number three, doing no harm.
Mm-hmm.
If you do indeed take the position that that embryo is a form of human life and you're destroying human life, well, you can't say that you're not doing any harm.
Correct. And that's why the science in medicine, the possibility of creating stem cells without destroying an embryo, will probably be the next biggest facet of technology.
Let's talk about what's going on in Madison right now. As you know, Wisconsin is a leader in stem cell technology, and the governor, as we speak, is in Ireland and the United Kingdom on a business trip, and he is trying to develop new markets for that technology. He is trying to not only market the stem cell, the embryonic stem cell technology that was developed at UW-Madison, he is also trying to develop relationships between various research centers around the world that are going to be engaging in this kind of research, whether we in the United States do it or not. I had a chance to talk to Governor Doyle in Stevens Point this week on that very subject. Here he is telling us about his trip to the United Kingdom.
I'll be meeting with stem cell researchers in the United Kingdom, and really hoping that we can solidify the ties with Wisconsin, which is one of the world leaders.
You think there's a real opportunity to export Wisconsin stem cell technology?
I think there is no doubt there's the opportunity will be for major research centers to be having a lot of different exchanges with one another. And as we're beginning to develop some of the first stem cell businesses in the United States here in Wisconsin, businesses growing out of the stem cell research that's been done here, I think a market for that is in the United Kingdom.
How do you respond to critics who still have an ethical problem with embryonic stem cell research, people who consider it tantamount to destroying human life?
Well, I think that debate's largely over. I believe that the scientists in Wisconsin work under very strict ethical standards, and I believe people understand that this holds the potential cure for illnesses that we long thought to be incurable. And I think people also understand that here in Wisconsin, where we are the absolute world leader, we have the opportunity to create a significant part of our economy. It isn't just stem cell research, but biomedical research. Wisconsin is just one of the emerging leaders. So this is an enormous opportunity for us to not only work to cure illnesses people long thought to be incurable, but also to create a lot of very good jobs as well.
And again, you're looking at exporting that technology to other countries.
Well, we're looking at a number of different things. One is exporting it. The other is making sure we have good, strong agreements and relationships between research centers around the world, the United Kingdom and Wisconsin, and that we are supporting one another. This isn't going to be winner-take-all. It isn't going to be that just Wisconsin is engaged in stem cell research and no one else is. There are going to be 4, 5, 6, 10 major research centers in the world. Wisconsin will be one of them, and we want to make sure we have good relationships with the others as well.
Mark Brown, Frank Lozinski, a couple of thoughts there. First of all, it's not going to be winner-take-all. There are research centers all around the world that are going to be engaging in this, whether we do it or not, and therefore maybe we should do it because Wisconsin is a leader.
We, the United States, is doing it. It's just not being funded with National Endowment for Health money. It's not illegal in the United States to conduct embryonic stem cell research. And it, there are many private institutions and state-sponsored institutions, such as in California and Massachusetts and in Wisconsin, where this research is being vigorously pursued. But it also is being conducted in a number of other places in the world, often under much less strict ethical guidelines than what is found here in Wisconsin.
And I guess the other question is if it is being pursued here in the United States with private money, not public funds, what is the difference? The president made a big deal of restricting the stem cell lines, the public funding, to only several existing lines, but he didn't in any way, shape, or form shut this down. He didn't say that we aren't going to do it because it's tantamount to murder, therefore we shouldn't be doing it with private money either. He didn't even try to make that case to the American people.
He did try and make the case that there is a serious moral problem with destruction of new embryos. He suggested that the taxpayer, the federal taxpayer, should not be involved.
We're going to have to hold your thoughts right there, Mark Brown. If you're on the line, you hold on the line. We're going to get to you right after the news. We are back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network. I'm Glenn Mobrick. Today we are talking about bioethics and the ethics of embryonic stem cell research in the wake of a day-long conference that took place Tuesday at the Westwood Center in UW-Marathon County in Wausau. Our guests, Mark Brown, Chair of the Philosophy Department at UW-Marathon County, and Frank Lozinski, Chair of the Bioethics Committee of Aspirus Wausau Hospital. We're also taking your phone calls at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. And Mark, we ran right into the news there at in the middle of a discussion, so I want to kind of tie a bow around it. We were talking about President Bush, who restricted public funding for stem cell research, but he didn't ban private funding, and he didn't really make a serious effort to try to get it banned.
Well, President Bush's 2001 policy had two important implications that we are still grappling with. One is that National Endowment for the Health funds were not available for this kind of research, and that by far is the largest pot of money in the United States or in the world. And admit that much of this research was either conducted overseas or was conducted by private companies in the United States. And that had the result that there is no general oversight for this research as it's conducted in the United States and state governments, and no general way of determining whether or not it's done ethically. Now, in the 2008 election, all three presidential candidates are in favor of National Institutes for Health funding. So now is the time for all of us to think about what sort of regulatory and ethical conditions should be put in place by the federal government.
And that includes John McCain, who has said that he is a right-to-life candidate.
That's correct. It's possible to be anti-abortion and also pro-embryonic stem cell research.
Let's go to the phones. Lane in Madison has been waiting patiently with a question, I believe, on adult stem cells versus embryonic. Lane, you're on Route 51.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm going to just ask my question, and then I'll get off the phone so that my wife and I can listen to the answer. One of the arguments that I've heard against embryonic stem cell research is that all of the commercial applications that have been developed so far have come from adult stem cell research, and that any possible benefits from embryonic stem cell research are way down the road, if there are any. So if you could comment on that, I'd very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Lane, thanks so much for the phone call. Frank, you want to tackle that, or
no,
Mark?
I'm going to throw that to Mark.
All right.
The caller is correct that only clinical applications of stem cell research is adult stem cells and is principally for treatment of blood-borne conditions. And there are thousands of them which are conducted in hospitals all over the United States and have been for about 10 years. It's a mature technology, but it's also a limited technology. Adult stem cells are what are called multipotent. They're capable of turning into many kinds of cells, but not all of them. They're not capable of turning into pancreatic cells or neural cells or cardiac cells. So if we're going to have stem cell type treatments for those kinds of health conditions, adult stem cells are probably not going to provide a pathway.
Again, the ethical question, Mark, always centers around exactly when human life begins. And speaking on one side of that issue, at the seminar was Patrick Lee. He's a professor of philosophy and director of the Bioethics Institute at Franciscan University of Steubenville. He believes that the research involves the destruction of human life.
First of all, the embryo is clearly a distinct, the embryos are distinct individuals. They are not parts of the mother in which they reside. This is clear from the fact that they grow in their own direction. So this is a distinct being. Secondly, it's obviously a human, something human. It's a product of humans, and it has the genetic structure that is characteristic of humans. And the third point I want to make, and this is perhaps the most important, is that this is a whole human being. But all it needs is a suitable environment and nutrition in order to actively develop itself to the mature stage of a human being. These three points are points that can be shown by biology or by embryology. And in fact, if you consult the embryology text, the standard embryology textbooks, all of them will say, well, you and I, or the human being, individual, began at fertilization. They still say that, okay? And so it's not that right-wing people or Catholics or whatever are bucking science. It's not religious people bucking science. No, we're the ones who are defending science. Okay? Now, if we are subject to rights because of the kind of being we are, then it would follow that you and I were subject to rights as soon as we came to be. We did not first come to be at one point and then acquire rights at some later time. Rather, we were subject of rights from the moment that we came to be. So you and I have been subject of rights at all times that we existed. We didn't first come to be and then become subject of rights later on. But if you and I once were embryos, which I think has been shown earlier, then you and I were subject of rights when we were embryos. So you and I once were embryos. If what makes you and I subject of rights is what we are, then we were subject of rights when we were embryos. And that means embryos are subject of rights.
Mark Brown, comment just briefly on the philosophical basis for this argument.
Patrick Lee is certainly right that something very important happens at the moment of fertilization. A new human genotype comes into existence. And he's also right that this is a form of human life. It's a biological individual. But it is not clear that what comes into existence at the point of fertilization is a baby, or that at the point at which stem cell research is conducted 1 week is a point at which there has been any embryological development at all. What seems to happen in the first 4 or 5 days is that the construction of a placenta occurs. There is no development at all of the cells which will become the fetus and which will become the baby. So one might say that that biological individual, that human form of life at 1 week, is a placenta, not a embryo.
We're going to listen to Cynthia Cohen talk about the other side of this issue. And again, she wasn't there as an advocate. She was just spelling out for the audience the positions that some people have who do not think that this constitutes the destruction of human life. Again, we're talking about a very small thing, an embryo that's only 4 days old for embryonic stem cell research, about the size of the head of a pin. And she is going to describe three different theories of those who favor embryonic stem cell research, do not consider it to be the destruction of human life. It's the 14-day theory, the person theory, and what she calls the clump of cells theory.
These are embryos that are about 4 or 5 days after fertilization. So when people link this question to the abortion question, they're not quite right, because obviously the abortion question arises much later. The size of the embryo would be even smaller than the dot of an eye. There are those who would say that this is much too early a period of time in which to say that you have a single entity that is an individual human being. At about 14 days after fertilization, twinning is no longer possible. Therefore, before 14 days, there's no individual integrated organism present. And it's only at this later point that you have either actual human being, or some would argue a potential human being. They would say even at the 14-day point, you don't have an actualized being. It has the potential to become one. Does it have to have, you know, brain waves? Does it have to have certain organs of the human body? There are a variety of positions that have been taken on this. There's the person view. People with this view say we don't owe the early embryo, the early human embryo, protection from destruction because it just is not a person. It has no conscious experience, can't suffer, has no sensibilities whatsoever. A third view we'll call the clump of cells view. And it says, look, at this time, you don't find the kind of complexity that you find in human organisms in this 4 to 5 day old embryo. Each is a collection of primitive and undifferentiated cells. They say much as it's right to use a collection of tissues, such as a kidney, to treat those with serious diseases, so it's right to use a collection of tissues, such as the early embryo, to treat those with serious diseases as well.
And again, Mark Brown, Cynthia Cohen laying out the positions, and again, she was not there as an advocate herself. She was telling you what some people involved in this research believe. But it sounds to me like the 14-day theory that this embryo isn't a human being until at least 14 days because of certain biological traits that it develops. And the clump of cells theory, they sound pretty similar to me.
They are. But at 14 days, it is widely accepted that something very important happens. This is the cutoff point for stem cell research in most other parts of the world, in the United Kingdom, in Australia. And what happens at 14 days is that the embryo itself starts to develop, as opposed to the extra embryonic structures. You have the creation of a front and a back end. The genes actually begin to express themselves in biological processes, which are identifiable with the fetus and with the baby. And then twinning is no longer possible.
Twinning is where blastocyst, the primitive embryo, can split and split again. So the argument is that maybe we don't have an individual here because this thing can split and split again and turn into doublets or triplets or quadruplets.
It's very puzzling to think about the early stages of an embryo. Yes, at the 2 or 3 days, the embryo can split off into 2 or 3 new embryos, each of which can become a fetus and a child. This happens in about 3% of pregnancies. So somewhat strikingly, it's also possible for two embryos at 2 or 3 days to get too close together and fuse and turn into a single embryo. And this suggests to many people that the biological individuality of the baby has not been formed because there has not been a separation of function between the cells.
And then it appears that the loosest perspective would be the person theory. Something isn't a person until it has feelings, consciousness, experience. You would at least, I imagine, have to wait until you could find brainwaves in the embryo to...
That's correct. This is the basis, the philosophical basis for Roe versus Wade, which suggests that at the third trimester in which there does seem to be cerebral function, there's brain waves, that there could be severe restrictions imposed on pregnancy termination. That would be the most liberal view.
Frank Lozinski, your general personal perspective as you listen to these arguments, we're talking about the fundamentals of human life, the fundamentals of existence, and the arguments being posed are not simple ones.
Not at all. When you look at the separate sperm and egg joining in fertilization along the continuum after 9 months to birth, you're looking for specific pinpoint areas along that continuum where you feel or think decisions can and should or may not be able to be made. I smiled when you guys were talking about consciousness because one of the last questions asked Tuesday night discussed the birth of consciousness. And there's a philosophical argument that was brought about by Descartes that Mark maybe can touch on that talked about
cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am.
Consciousness being created around day 49. We're in the seventh week of the continuum. And so who knows?
But let's pursue Patrick Lee's argument for a while. And I'm going to give you a hypothetical here, and I'd like to get your reaction to it. It's kind of a Hobson's choice. But if you're assuming that this blastocyst, 4 days old, the size of the head of a pin, is a full human being with all the rights, the constitutional rights of a baby or a three-year-old boy or a girl or a full-grown human being, what if you were to take any parent with a three-year-old son or a three-year-old daughter, somebody that they'd raised, fed, watched learn how to walk, learn how to talk, and then you were to say to this parent, whoever it is, all right, over here I've got two of these little embryonic stem cells. Those are worth two human beings to your one. Ethically, instead of killing these two embryonic stem cells, I'm going to kill your son or your daughter, and I'll allow you to make the choice. Which one should die? The two stem cells, the two embryos, the two tiny embryos, or the three-year-old son or daughter? Would you be able to find any parent, even right-to-life parents, in this country who would make that choice?
I think Patrick Lee would be willing to make a similar kind of choice. The scenario that you paint, Glenn, has been considered and for some time by people who worry about this. A variation on it is that there is a fire in a fertility clinic. And the fire threatens the child care facility in which there are two or three small children, toddlers, 2 or 3 years old. And it threatens the 100 or more embryos. Which is the right group to save first? Should one save the embryos, which is 50 children, or should one save the toddlers in the child care center? To his credit, Professor Lee and others say that all 50 of the embryos are children and they should be saved. I say to his credit because he is consistent.
He is consistent.
And let the children and the toddlers wait their turn.
And he does take that position.
He doesn't. I don't know if he takes it with respect to his own children.
Uh-huh.
He has nine. but he takes it in general. In such a situation, the right thing to do would be to save the greatest number of children.
And some would say that you are taking an abstract philosophical position there, and you are extrapolating it to the point where it bears no relationship to what most human beings would do using their own common sense intuition of what's right and what's wrong.
I think Patrick Lee and his colleagues are in a minority and with respect to that type of situation that you described, Glenn.
We're taking your phone calls if you want to join this conversation. We are discussing the ethics of embryonic stem cell research, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the third speaker, R. Alto Charo, professor of law and bioethics at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She discussed specifically those who say they are part of the right-to-life movement, but who have found exceptions for abortions in some cases, and in some cases for embryonic stem cell research.
If one steps back for a moment and looks at the nature of the objections to abortion, you can detect that in the reasoning there's often two lines of thought that are not always teased out. And the one we hear about all the time in the newspaper is the one that focuses on the sanctity of life from the earliest moments of its development. And yet within the right to life movement, if you listen closely, you'll hear that there are some who will, in fact, tolerate the legality of abortion if you have cases of rape or incest. So for those who would make an exception for rape or incest, there is embedded in their own reasoning some kind of intrinsic notion that we can balance the interests of a woman who has been harmed psychologically by an attack upon herself against our interest in the sanctity of that life. And they will make that balance in a way they never would for a live-born child, whom they would certainly not permit to be murdered in order to assuage the emotional damage that's been done to a woman who's been raped. And whereas in an advanced pregnancy by a woman who they don't view as somehow innocent of having brought about the conception, they may be comfortable saying that the moral status is sufficiently great that abortion should be prohibited and the pregnancy must continue. In other cases, they may be willing to make some balancing acts. Here, where the woman's been attacked and is innocent of having brought about the pregnancy. And now in the case of embryonic stem cell research, they're presented with another balance. And it's the balance of the child in the wheelchair, the child with diabetes type 1, the relative who is declining from Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease, or the most horrible, I think, of all of them, Lou Gehrig's disease. And faced with those kinds of pictures of human suffering, they ask, should I be balancing here as well?
And again, the two examples that come to mind are President Bush Sr., who made a famous exception for rape or incest in his opposition to abortion, and John McCain, who is in favor of embryonic stem cell research and the public funding of it, even though he touts his right to life credentials.
That's right. And I think that it's because a balancing of the type Alto Charo described is going on among the political leaders and among the public, trying to give full weight to the medical benefits that could come from stem cell research, and also to respect the sanctity of human life and to be very careful about how this type of research is done.
And that isn't that really what's particularly frightening when you start talking about things like human cloning, when you start talking about inserting animal genes into human beings in order to change traits or determining sexes in advance, or maybe even as the Spartans used to do, discarding embryos that have certain flaws. Isn't that the rubric that we're really worried about in a lot of cases, Frank?
Well, they talked about the difficulty of nations coming up with their own policies and procedures in the study of embryonic research, and how difficult it is to control what other nations do that don't have the controls that we do or the policies and procedures that we follow here in the United States. And what would be the outcome if stem cells are transferred into animal cells in order to treat cancer or different other diseases, and some mutation of that gene that produces some disease that we don't have an immunity to would run rampant across the human race and destroy. So there are so many issues that I think spin our heads around, or at least they spin my head around.
Yeah, I remember as a child reading the H.G. Wells novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and thinking that this was something that was just so far afield that it was nothing we'd ever have to deal with in our lifetime, and indeed we do have to deal with it, don't we?
Yes, it's possible to create human-animal hybrids or chimeras, and for some purposes it may even be a good idea. After all, those technologies, those stem cell technologies, are dangerous. They could cause more harm to the human patients than good. We just don't know. They could give them cancer. So we should try out those human stem cell technologies on animals first to see whether or not they are safe. That's standard procedure in development of new medical technologies. Do the animal trial.
And on that note, we are going to draw things to a close, and I think that's probably the subject of an entirely different show. A Brave New World, indeed. We're talking to Mark Brown, chair of the philosophy department at UW-Marathon County, Frank Lozinski, chair of the bioethics committee of Aspirus Wausau Hospital. I'm Glenn Mobrick. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 on the Ideas Network. And next Thursday, we welcome Sammy Rizzulli, the man who's been called the Gandhi of Iraq, a successful Minneapolis businessman and restaurant owner who moved back to his native Iraq in 2004 following the U.S. invasion and who is now working for peace in his homeland. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our phone screener, Kelson Quisler. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. That does it for us today. Thanks to all of you for riding along with us. And until next week, we are heading out of town.